Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's go back to 2011 with Squidge. Let's look at the World Cup again with Squidge.
Hello and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective Podcast, the only rugby podcast with more syllables in its name than the entire Georgian front row. Today, my name's Robbie or Squidge or whatever you want to call me. As ever, I'm joined by apparently Nottingham Rugby's Player of the Season, Will Owen.
That's me, for anyone wondering.
Yeah, and definitely not someone else that happens to share your name.
No. I'm an open side flanker, if anyone asks, despite my stature.
Yeah, and joining us from the Scottish Rugby Podcast, Cammy Black.
Hello, I was once trainer of the season in my very first season playing rugby, which is basically he turned up on time and put in a little more effort than anybody else, but it was roundly rubbish.
I tell you what, I've got that. I got that my first two seasons in a row playing. I got Clubman of the Year, which just meant he turns up and he drops the ball for an hour, then he goes home and doesn't complain.
I came third on Most Improved, which means I was shit and did not get much better. Like, it wasn't the real materials to begin with, but, you know, he tried.
How did they have a third for that? You like just say, well, there's Most Improved. Why would you then rank people?
It only went down to the bronze medal place. He didn't rank right down to the bottom. They went down to, like, either you were really good in the first place or, oh, you should have quit.
It's a strange criteria for getting nominated for Most Improved, isn't it? You never know quite how to feel because it's like, well, that implies you thought I was shit 12 months ago.
Yeah. And I did feel like the person that won it over me, the person that came first, was actually quite good in the first place. So, I don't know.
Sounds like you're a Rob, mate.
Absolutely. Outright.
If you're also working from a lower base level, then yeah, clearly.
That's how it works. I think going from 2% good to 8% good is better than going from 90% good to 92% good. But, you know, what do I know? Apparently very little. 92 is the highest number we're going to hear today, I think.
Yeah.
Because we are here to talk about...
We could talk about the amount of times Dan Park's kicked.
Yeah.
Well, his kicking percentage, no, that's less than 92.
We're on the game we've all been looking forward to. Scotland's 15-6 win over Georgia. Cammy, thank you for volunteering. Thank you for agreeing, at least, even volunteering to do this one.
This particular community service.
Honestly, this wasn't as bad as I thought it was. When you asked me to do this, my heart sank. I was obviously pleased, not because you'd asked me to do this. I was obviously very happy with that, but just the idea of revisiting this game, because I've only watched it once. Yeah. And now because we do the podcast, I watch games at least twice. I watch it live and then I'll go back and look at it again. So this, I wasn't even writing for the blog at this point. I started writing for the Scottish Rugby blog, the Six Nations after this.
Right.
So going back, and this is the first time I've watched it again, and it wasn't as bad, as I may come on to, as I remember it. I think in my head I'd written it off as this horrendous game that never to be spoken of again.
Exactly, yeah. So, and to pick on the other person in the room, was that your impression as well?
It was probably as bad as I remember it personally. I mean, the thing is, with England-Argentina, I'd managed to talk myself into it being dreadful. I thought, yeah, it was pretty bad, you know? But with this, I simply couldn't get on with it, unfortunately.
See, that was our kind of brief, like, we were avoiding talking about the game in detail, but we both watched it now. And I said, well, it wasn't as bad as England-Argentina. And you disagreed.
Yeah.
And that was and I think genuinely this is it, the game's shorter than England-Argentina, which was a truly atrocious game and seemed to go on forever. There were so many stoppages and reset scrums. Whereas this one, thankfully, you know, it wasn't the most thrilling game, but they got on with it. They kind of moved through it quite quickly.
There was 100% less Martin Rodriguez in this game as well, to its defence.
That's very true. That's absolutely true.
I think what I did was, because I watched the first half, and I came away thinking, what have I just watched? But then I kind of came back at it and thought, well, this is Gregor Townsend as an attack coach.
Yeah.
Has anything changed? And actually, it's if you look at it from that point of view, the execution's awful. Right, let's get that out of the way. The execution and the way that the players are doing things. But if you look at the patterns they're playing, and then just because World Rugby had put it on, is World Rugby or Six Nations had put the highlights of the 2019 Calcutta Cup up on Twitter last night. And I was looking at going, some of the plays that Scotland were making in that Georgia match, they were executed absolutely atrociously. But the ideas are there. Yeah. You can see the blueprint for what Townsend then went and did at Glasgow and then went and did at, is now doing with Scotland. So when you looked at it, when I looked at it from that perspective, I was like, I can get into this game if I purely look at this from an attack point of view, because everything else about it is terrible.
I thought something similar, that this Scotland team is probably the closest to how they're playing now of any of the 20 teams in the 2011 World Cup. That actually, as I said, their attack patterns, obviously there's odd changes and things, and the fact that, you know, players are catching the ball in the way they weren't against Georgia. But it felt largely like they were trying to achieve the same thing, and it's kind of tightened up a bit since then. But it's the same ideas.
Yeah, and I think the problem is because they've come from... Townsend was attack coach under the late era Frank Haddon. But I think essentially Townsend's trying to get people who are playing snakes and ladders to play 3D chess. Yeah, they're just not able to understand the instructions, because it's just not the game they're trying to play or used to play. Yeah. But by the time he then comes back to Scotland again, he's been through Glasgow. The structures in Scotland are much more advanced. The academy system's better, so players are then able to grasp the kind of stuff he's asking them to do. Because some of the moves actually were, some of the moves, there was merit to a lot of what Scotland were trying. But and Dan Parks, who we will come on to, no doubt. Some of the things were all right. There was merit to what he was trying at times.
I think that's a good point about what you're saying about Townsend as well. It's just a shame that clearly in training he was saying, right, this is the point in the move where you knock it on when you see the 22-metre line.
I think the other thing that was really interesting is when you watched it, the stuff they were doing it about like 10, 20 metres back from the Georgian defence.
Yes.
And you think, well, if you'd actually just... And in the second half, they changed it. Because in the second half, they start playing a lot closer to the gain line. And when they do it, things were happening. They were breaking through. But at that point, the rain had come down and the pitch was slippy. If they'd done it in the first half, they might have got a couple of tries out of it.
Yeah.
But it was just... It was maddening watching them do little inside pop passes when nowhere near the Georgian defence. Like, well, whose benefit is that for?
Yeah. I think a lot of that, though, is just Dan Parks being so afraid of contact.
Oh, it's awful.
And
to watch,
just the way in which he went so far out of his way to avoid... I mean, like, yes, defence you take for granted, but he wouldn't go anywhere near the attacking line, the defensive line, when he had the ball. And there's a moment in defence I noted where it's kind of Georgia have quite a messy line out and they just chuck it randomly and Godze takes it. And by this point, he charges onto the ball because he has to in order to get it. And he comes on with a full head of steam and he runs straight at Dan Parks. And Parks doesn't just step out of the way. He actually runs. He runs laterally and leaves Ross Rennie to make the tackle instead.
I loved looking at Ross Rennie's body language there. Just kind of like, because he had a brief like looking over to Parks moment. Yeah. Kind of like, you prick. Leaving it to him and Graham Morrison to have to do like a two-man shot on him. Well, Parks is just like, anyway, I'm just going to go and quickly call my mum or something. Like, I'll be back in a second. Just deal with this big man.
There's something on my boots. I've just got to wipe them clean before we go any further.
My theory with Parks in this game is he hasn't got pointy sideburns. And I think that's from where he gets all the source of all his powers. And that's why he's kicking so terrible, and that's why his decision making in this game is just all over the place. It's because he didn't cut himself in some pointy sideburns.
See, okay, now I want to just shift off Dan Parks for a second, because I've got a similar theory that I picked up on this game. So I noticed this is maybe the cleanest shaven Georgia team I've ever seen. There's at least four players without beards, which is bizarre. Like, I had a moment of looking at Merab Kokashvili, who I'm a big fan of anyway, and I sort of didn't recognise him at first. And when I did, I put together, like, I forgot he was sort of handsome. And I was like, why is that? It's like, oh, no, because I'm used to him having a chinchilla attached to his chin at all times. Like, he normally has this massive, thick beard, which for, like, a 10 fullback, you don't expect. But then I began to think about it, and I realised, actually, how Georgia have done in each World Cup, in the last three World Cups, has been directly proportional to how much facial hair Mamuka Godze had. So 2011, yes, they beat Romania, but they can't, and they kind of have a decent game against Scotland, as we're talking about here, but they really struggle against England and Argentina, and yet they still lose to Scotland in a game they possibly could have won. And, you know, he's got not much facial hair whatsoever. There's a bit, like, he hasn't shaved that morning, but it's not real facial hair. 2015, proper beard, best Georgian performance we've seen at World Cup, goes without saying. 2019, again, like, he's got this kind of patchy beard. Like, there's a signs of a beard there, but he's shaving a bit too often for it to grow through properly. And that kind of reflects the Georgian performance. They had the odd game where they kind of stood up, like, against Australia, but really they weren't quite there. And that's my theory on Georgia, is what we need is Gogodza to grow, like, a full Dumbledore, and they'll win the World Cup.
That's irrefutable.
I like that theory. I think my note on the Georgian team was just, these all look like secondary Bond villains.
Yes, they do.
The entire team, like forwards and backs, I was just like, they all look like henchmen. I think it's because they're clean shaven, because of course, you know, all kind of Bond villains obviously have standards for their employees to be clean shaven and turn up well dressed for work. So I think that kind of added to the look.
We've never seen that, have we? The handbook they hand out. Like, do Bond villains have a HR section?
Hey, you must turn up to work dressed as this. Well, they all have uniforms, don't they?
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah, when they're, you know, turning up for day one on that Russian submarine.
So someone's taken time to think about that, and that's important, isn't it? Brand, you know, brand awareness is important.
Oh, absolutely.
And so that's really important to Bond villains, you know, rather than just like lads, just, you know, it's casual Friday down the submarine. Jeans and T-shirt, just wear what you want. Stick a pound in for charity.
Yeah. I actually applied for a job doing social media for a Bond villain. Yeah, it didn't go very well. You know, they wanted to be a bit po-faced. They weren't taking the jokes very well. I had a note on David Zurakashvili as well, that he looks like, you know, like those like stone Buddhas you see in parks. Like, he looks like one of those. Like, he looks like a statue of quite a fat man, because he's so solid. Like, there's no wobble in his kind of, because he's a big round bloke, but there's no wobble in it at all. Like, he's somehow a round ball of muscle. And not in, like, even the Nick Grigg way. He's a bizarre shape, and he looks like he's made of stone.
I wasn't aware that they were Buddhas. I thought I was just seeing stone versions of David Zurakashvili plastered around every garden.
They're kind of fat weeping angels, yeah.
I tell you what, though, someone that's having a lot of fun with that Georgian front row was Alan Jacobson.
Oh, yes.
There was a lot of grinning and winking and winding up going on during that game. He was having I was trying to find it before this. There was an article I read once, and I think it was when he retired, and it was it might have been Al Kellogg who'd been asked to give a quote about Chunk retiring, and it was this game he talked about, and he said as they were in the tunnel, Chunk looked up at the heavens and saw it was going to rain, and he kind of went, it's a day for my kind of rugby. And you can just see that all the way through this game, that he is in his element. It is pissing down with rain, and he is just throwing himself everywhere, having a, like, literally like a pig in shit. That's how he looks like for this whole game, and it's wonderful.
Oh, no, it is. And it was kind of a few minutes in, I went to check who the Scottish loose head was, because I expect Alan Jacobson to always have those moments where he kind of has those, like, chunky wobbles that he does, where he kind of, like, somehow bursts through the defence. And it happened all the time, where he'd make a break and then look completely lost, like he'd never done it before, when actually it happened the previous week.
It was a great point in the second half, I think, where he made a break, somehow lost the ball backwards, and then managed to regather it whilst the Georgian had hold of his shirt at full stretch. And the interesting thing about these shirts is that Scott, this was the first year that the SRU did, like, video content on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they did is they got players to try and tear apart the shirts as a bit of a promo for the shirts. So these shirts are tough, because they couldn't get Ross Ford or Richie Gray to tear one apart. And that's still, that's still on YouTube, is videos of players actually tearing it apart at the neck.
I reckon they must have asked Ali Strokosh, and then he must have just gone, and just, like, pulled it apart straight away. Like, with not using any strength, and then just, oh, well, that just disproves our point.
He just
never uploaded it.
Al Strokosh looked at the shirt and fell apart.
Started crying.
It disintegrated into mere particles. That's how you break something. That's how you split the atom, is you get Al Strokosh to look at one. Isn't there a story about Al Strokosh, and I've got no idea whether this is true or not, about, because he lived on a farm when he was at Gloucester, and he got so annoyed at, I think, missing out on the 2007 World Cup squad that he went and killed a sheep.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that's true.
Yeah. It sounds like the kind of thing he'd do. It's completely in character.
I think he and Vern Cotter got on quite well.
Yeah.
Yes. Whereas
they look exactly, they look, he could be Vern Cotter's son if you look at him.
Yes.
He's shaven hair, completely clean shaven, all over.
Yeah.
And you know it's all over as well.
Yeah. One glance.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas any of this Georgian team, I reckon, could just inhale a sheep in one bite. They could just instantly eat them and swallow them. To quickly touch on the teams, to quickly run through them, we had both the Lamont brothers in the Scottish team, which is always a rare treat, and one Evans brother on the other. There's a moment, and I'll just head on to this, where Max Evans takes a high ball, and Zibzadadze, the Georgian 12, genuinely murders him. Like, I think there's an actual death takes place. I think, like, a priest comes on and gives him the last rites before he catches it. It's quite horrific. It's like watching a freight train just crash into a teacup. Like, he's shattered into a thousand pieces. It's brutal, and I loved it.
Well, what was great about it was, like, it's like he shattered the teacup, but somehow the teacup reassembled itself and still kept the tea inside because he kept hold of the ball.
Yeah. Oh, it's so... And because when he did the slow motion version... You see Max Evans' whole body kind of just like rumple. A bit like, you know, Chris Ashton's face when Manu Dulangi punched him. It's like Max Evans' body does that in full. Except that, like, the ball stays under his arm and it doesn't even, like, he doesn't almost lose and regather it. It's safely tucked in.
Did you notice for the rest of the game just how little Max Evans wanted the ball
as well? And as soon as he'd get it, he'd
try and step out of it and try and pass it. At one point, he passes it along the floor as well. And, like, there's one point where for Kvirokashvili, that first long-range penalty he gets, where he's somehow offside from an up and under on first phase, which obviously Dan Park's going to do that. How do you mistime your run on that? Yeah.
It's the first time a winger's ever avoided getting the ball deliberately.
Well, the interesting thing about the Rory Lamont and Max Evans in this game, and it may be this game that caused this, but they've both gone on to become massive 5G conspiracy theorists.
Have they?
Yes. Genuinely. So if you watch Max Evans' Instagram at the minute, and it varies day to day, and I've had to keep screenshots so I don't get in trouble over this because I've said it on the podcast before, but he will occasionally post these videos of, like, it's the entry level. Like meditation stuff, you know, where it's like, oh, meditate and it'll help you relax. And that's all great. But then it moves on to, you can control the world with your thoughts. And he started to talk about stuff like this and manifesting. At one point, he was talking to people about manifesting cities in the sky that he could go and live in. And then reposting 5G conspiracy videos on his Instagram stories. And you look at Rory Lamont's Twitter and Instagram, and it's just the same kind of stuff. It's all about how we should just visualize a different world and it'll happen. And within all that is buried, and 5G is killing the earth and killing our minds. So I don't know if something happened on this tour during this World Cup to these two, that they got together and just started reading David Icke.
Do you think it was during this game they started to imagine a better world where they weren't playing in it?
They had nothing better to do but talk about 5G conspiracies, did they, during this game?
I've just looked at Roy Lamont's Twitter bio. Is "The truth lies within."
Yes.
An emoji of the earth.
Wow.
Yeah, this is... You're spot on.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really deep. I mean, I would also add that, interestingly enough, I think around part, and this kind of builds into what happened in this game and what happened since with Scottish rugby, this is really the time where Scottish rugby didn't prioritise welfare at all. Right. So Rory Lamont in particular has been really unlucky. I think he talked about his experiences in France and going away and not being forced to play concussed and things like that. But I'm not sure. I think in concussion, Scottish rugby were fine. But I think in terms of looking after players' mental well-being, I don't think they were on top of their game around this time. When you look at what Graham Morrison has said recently in terms of how he felt, I think there is an element of that. However, it is odd that the two-thirds of the back line are basically like spouting David Icke now.
Have we checked on Sean? Do we know for certain?
Sean doesn't buy into that kind of crap.
Okay. It's just as well they're socially distanced, the awkward Sunday dinners.
Yeah.
And Nick DeLuca's gotten away with this. We can't find any dirt on him, can we?
No, Nick DeLuca, it was a real shame the way Nick DeLuca kind of left Scotland, because he got dropped by Edinburgh and ended up going playing D2.
was at Perpignan, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
And he did all right for a bit, but I think his I think it was Italy, was an Italy game. He had a really bad game against Italy and got absolutely slaughtered on Twitter.
Mm.
And he never really came back from that. And it was kind of in the, I think it was very early doors Twitter where people didn't really understand that you shouldn't directly tweet people. I know it still happens, but not in the same way as it was happening back then. I think he's somebody else. I mean, this is the thing about this back line. You think you've got Rory Lamont, Max Evans, Graham Morrison and Nick DeLuca have all publicly spoken about how they struggle with mental health issues, which probably says something about the way that Scottish rugby were handling that kind of stuff at the time.
Yeah, yeah. That's really interesting. Mm. Yeah. And it was the thing with Nick DeLuca, and I remember because he was a good player, but whenever he had bad games, they were particularly noticeably bad. Like he was, and I think there was probably something mental in the fact that if he made a mistake early on, he'd start to make more and more.
Yeah.
And he was a player that was prone to having really standout bad games.
The Johnny Sexton effect.
Yeah, but where Sexton is just fuming at the world and starts to blame everyone else for the mistakes.
True.
I don't know if DeLuca was just blaming himself, and I think I'm putting this together in my head. Like,
I think he's spoken about that, and I think that's true. I mean, the interesting thing probably with most of this backline is they're not good at decision making.
Yeah.
And that's probably the difference between where Scotland were then and where they are now, is these players just are incapable of making the right decision at the right time and making decisions under pressure.
Yeah.
So occasionally they spark into life because something will come off and they'll just happen to make the right decision at some point, but it's just so random. Whereas I think there's a bit more control to Scotland now, decisions don't, and I think they're a bit more resilient. So, I mean, you look at Finn Russell and Adam Hastings. I mean, they make a mistake on the park, and I don't think there's no way it would bother them as much as it would bother Nick DeLuca or Dan Parks now.
And the other thing I love about this current Scotland backline is Sam Johnson, because he's so good at just absorbing people's mistakes that when someone else makes a mistake, he kind of takes it on himself and will take the ball into nothing.
There's a really good book. There's a book on Scottish rugby called Behind the Thistle that's written by David Barnes and a couple of other guys. Now, obviously, nobody that played for Scotland at this point is going to be selling autobiographies, so it was really hard to find anything about this particular game. But Behind the Thistle, they went, I think they've done similar books for Wales and England, but they've in that, there's an interview with Al Kellock where he says that Andy Robinson came in and had a no-excuse culture. So I think it all kind of started with Andy Robinson. I think Scotland now actually owe a lot to Andy Robinson watching this game back.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of no-excuse culture was something that he put in place. And I think before that, it would be, we did, Scotland played to the best of our ability and we played with pride. And I think he got rid of all that.
Yeah.
I always think there's something in the way a lot of what Eddie Jones did was built on what Stuart Lancaster did. And he kind of took the foundations and kind of sharpened off the edges that weren't working. I do think there's something in what Cotter and Townsend have done with Scotland that Robinson built a foundation of a team that was hard to beat. And you look at that win, that 8-9 win over Australia in 2009, which to me was kind of, that was the epitome of the Andy Robinson Australia. No, sorry, Andy Robinson Scotland. In that's a conspiracy theory. Get Max Evans on that. Andy Robinson was coaching bloody Australia, and that's why Matt Gitto missed deliberately. They were just really hard tackling. They're really hard working, and he kind of took the elements that were in his control in terms of making sure the team is really hard working. They're hard hitting. They work really hard in defence, and he knew he didn't have, as you say, it's the decision making. And it's like the Evans brothers and so on are really talented players, but they couldn't quite... Tom more so, but obviously we all know what happened a year prior to this. But Max Evans, I always thought, was a really talented player that could never quite use his talent properly. And I think it is the decision-making highlight.
Yeah,
I think they need that one player in the back line, like the Sam Johnsons, you remember earlier, Blair Kinghorn, the other one I was pointing out. And like Dan Parks, while he's a very sensible player, a very good kicker, probably doesn't have that sort of killer instinct as like a proper like test match animal that would beat your Southern Hemisphere teams. Rory Jackson being the other 10 and going to this World Cup as well. You compare that to Hastings and Russell as the two current 10s, that both just such decisive players, whether what they're doing is completely batshit crazy or it's completely the right option.
Yeah. And I think that's the point of difference, because I think you look at that back line and I think that technically, and I think watching this game again, with watching it back, and I haven't watched any of these players for a long time, but technically the stuff they're doing is all right. They're not, you wouldn't say none of these players are not international standard. They're all, I mean, even Graham Morrison throws a lovely inside pass at one point to send Sean Lamont away. So these players all technically have the skills and abilities to play at this level. the point of difference is it's the mental side of things. It's the decision making. It's making the right call at the right time and executing it well. And they're obviously all capable of doing that. It's just when the pressure comes on that they fall apart.
Yeah.
Which is classic Scotland. I mean, that's you know, the story of Scotland for time immemorial.
Yeah. Speaking of not making the right decisions at the right time, should we talk about Dan Park?
Yeah. I feel like it's inevitable.
Yeah.
I had a thought whilst watching this of I can't think of another rugby player I've ever watched that always, every single time he played, had such an impact on the game as Dan Park's. That you never didn't notice he was playing.
Yeah, yeah. I think my favourite moment of Dan Parks in this game was at half-time. I'm sure you both will have noticed as well. That he drops into the pocket and tries to send it out. I don't know if he's trying to do some kind of grubber into touch or something, but he obviously gets charged down because he takes about 3 years to drop the ball into his foot. And George are very unlucky not to score from that. And they end up going into half-time. And Dan Parks still has a completely straight face walking in.
The really thing, the weird thing about that is that all stemmed from his drop goal, right? Who does a drop goal on 78 minutes? Like, take it through two more minutes of phases and then do a drop goal and go in after scoring a drop goal. 78 minutes gives gives him time to restart. And I don't know, maybe there wasn't a clock in Invercargill, I don't know. But you know, it's 78 minutes. So Georgia restart, and then not once does he get charged down, but I think, does he get charged down twice?
Throughout the game, he certainly gets charged down more, yeah.
I think at one point, he gets charged down once, and then I think he tries to kick it sideways off the pitch and manages to get charged down. Yeah. How do you manage to get charged down whilst kicking a ball sideways off a pitch?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just not deep enough. And you watch it back, I mean, the second half, it's the same again. He's just not deep enough. And I don't know if that's a coaching problem or him, but he's just not, he's too close to... was it Rory Lawson was playing scrum half? Yeah. Lawson, he's too close to Lawson. So by the time Lawson delivers the ball, the Georgians are right up on him.
Yeah, yeah. And there's something about his commitment to not taking contact at all times means that once he's passed the ball, he always then just kind of floats away from the contact area rather than sort of committing and make himself a bit of a threat. And even if you know he's not going to carry, you know, as long as you don't sort of float away from the ball as you're passing it, then they've got to mark you.
There's a moment in which Sean Lamont makes a half break and offloads to Ross Rennie, who kind of goes straight through. And he's got Dan Parks in his support, and Parks begins to run away rather than be in position for the pass. And like, I don't want this. There's like too many Georgians. And I get scared when I'm around Welsh people. Never mind these lads. Look at them. It's a stone Buddha. He kind of literally runs away rather than anything to do with like being on what could have been a try scoring move. He's retaking the pass. It's impressive.
And the kick, he's kicking so erratic. Like his fourth kick, I think I wrote down the fourth kick is from the touchline, right? And he's missed the kick at this point. I think that was a really straightforward one from the post. His fourth kick is like really extreme, right on the touchline. And somehow he inexplicably nails it.
Yeah.
But when he's right in front of the post, he keeps pulling them out. I don't know what.
That first one is shanks. The first one that he shanks, where I've got it written down on my notes. I've just put Park shanks it, kill me.
And there's a point in the second half where he goes for a penalty from the halfway line, and at this point it's clear the Georgian line out is in all sorts of trouble, even on their own line out, let alone the Scotland one. So you think you're on the halfway line, you're kicking at this point is 50%. Kick to the corner for Christ's sake, because you will probably score a try. They were blowing. I mean, the Georgians, about 55 minutes, the Georgians are blowing.
Yeah.
So the chance that you're gonna drive them over or stretch the defence, why go for a kick when you're kicking at 50% at that point? And then when Chris Patterson comes on, he keeps kicking duties. They bring on a man who can never miss.
Instead, they stay with a man who can never not kick.
Yeah.
So he's a sort of unstoppable object and believable force. I can't remember what that phrase is. It's gone completely. that sentence really got away from me.
Yeah. There was a few moments I noticed when Jim Hamilton was just looking ever so slightly mildly pissed off with just everybody around him, because he was genuinely having a very good game, actually. And like his set piece was all completely fine, all going through him, lineouts. And it was just like, I think Georgia were even calling the lineouts to Jim Hamilton. That's how present he was. And then...
quite a quiet first half. There was a lot of ruck inspecting going on. And I really, Robbie, after your interview, I really hope he's not listening to this, because I know you like.
I've got his number now. I could just text him, let him know.
Text him and tell him I was slagging him off in the podcast. Yeah. But there was a lot of kind of that thing where he was just wandering between rucks and having a little look like he was inspecting like a dodgy car on its MOT or something. But the second half, he kind of really came out and was all, like you said, Will, he really seemed to kind of take the game by the scruff of the neck in the second half.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I think naturally that Scotland lineup's always going to go pretty well as well, because the thing is, I don't really know these two Georgian second rows very well. Obviously, they've got some decent options in the back row, pretty athletic, Gorgodza, Basilaya, Colin Ashvili coming off the bench. But like that second row, I can't imagine are the fittest. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And like Hines and Hamilton's a strong second choice, second row partnership.
Though, I want to take a moment to highlight Mr. Chikakadze, who was the Georgian replacement lock, who came on and inside 5 minutes had taken Dan Park's late three times and not been penalised for it once. I was like, I love you. And he was wearing like a bright white scrum cap as well, so you could notice him every time in amongst all the kind of bald, weirdly shaved faces of the Georgian team.
Clearly he's been watching Dan Parks and thinking, just because you didn't have the ball does not mean you can avoid contact, mate. You got something coming.
To quickly move on to the Georgian team a bit, I mentioned Joe Kashvili, who at the time was one of the best tight heads in the world. This was kind of the tournament where Mamuka Gorodze really announced himself. He'd been playing for Montpellier for about a year or two before this, and then after this World Cup kind of came through as like, no, I am Georgian rugby, and everyone will love me for the next how many ever years. Because he had him starting, and I thought he had a good game, Gorodze.
He got stripped by Ross Rennie at one point.
Yes.
He got stripped by Dan Parks at one point as well. Where Parks just inexplicably found himself in a defensive line by accident. What do I do here?
But that was his whole thing. If he ever found himself having to make a tackle, he always went for the ball. He always went for a strip. Because potentially he could do something useful.
I think any player that gets stripped by Dan Parks should be forced to retire.
That's why Gogadze's done it. He saw we were going to rewatch this game. I went, someone will notice. Shit. Call it off. The glittering career is over. George also had, I've mentioned him in passing, Merab Kurukashvili at fly half, who I love, and I don't even know why, but I remember I joined this World Cup, like 15 or something,
like
trying to get the hashtag Merab Kurukashvili is perfect trending, and it never did.
Yeah.
But there are still some dodgy tweets from like 14, 15-year-old me if you scroll back to those.
Yeah, yeah. I remember trying to help you out, but we each had about 20 followers, so I feel like not going to go somewhere. So.
Yeah. And like he straight away nails a penalty from his own half, like a few minutes into the game. And I thought I was onto something. He is perfect. I knew what I was talking about way back when. And he also at one point, this was my favourite Merab moment, he, quite early on, first time Georgia get into the Scotland half, he goes for a drop goal. And in the process, he falls over. He kicks the ball so hard, he falls flat on his back. And he doesn't even just stumble a bit like that Wilkinson-Farrell one. Or no one's near him. He just kicks it and kind of knocks himself completely off balance as he's doing it. And falls, bam, flat on his back. Love it.
Yeah, Curtly Beal moment. And then, of course, he has the second one in the second half, another drop goal attempt, where it's the ball that's going along the floor rather than him at the time.
Yeah, did not go according to plan at all.
No.
The other really interesting thing is the Georgia coach at the time, Richie Dixon. Richie Dixon has the second best win rate of any Scotland coach. He is second only to Jim Telfer. So he's got a better win percentage than Ian McGeachan had with Scotland. Wow. And he almost won. It's the 1996... 96, I'll get this right because you'll get letters otherwise. Yeah, the 1996 Five Nations, Scotland almost won that. So we went down to the last game against England, which they lost. So they beat everybody bar England in that Five Nations. And he also had Gregor Townsend as his captain on the summer tour that year as well. And we've just done Gregor Townsend's autobiography is like a book club on the podcast.
Right, yeah. So,
which is really interesting because there's no way he'd write that now because he writes it after he's left as a player and it's pretty much, it's literally two fingers up, sticking two fingers to Scottish rugby and everything going, I'm retired, fuck off everybody. That's like he literally writes down who his enemies are and people he's never spoken to again.
Wow.
But Richie Dixon, he really rated because he got really, when he took one, nobody would play Townsend as a fly half and Richie Dixon said, I'll play you as a fly half. they played really expansive running rugby. And I think that's watching this Georgian team, you almost get a sense that's what he's trying to do with Georgia.
Yeah.
He's run that kind of game. And I think he's quite well respected. He was in charge of Georgia for a while, I think, as well, and didn't do... I don't think his win ratio with Georgia, I think, was fairly high. But then, obviously, the teams they play, they're not playing Tier 1 nations, so...
No.
But I think it is something up like 70% or something, like 70-80% with Georgia.
Which is really impressive. And this was kind of the period in which Georgia became a force that are good enough for people to complain about them not being in the Six Nations, rather than just kind of a novelty act. It was kind of that... They had that one performance against Ireland in 2007 when people went, oh, they're all right. You know, they're not just some big lads. And then 2011, 2015 is when people start to take them seriously a bit. And I think, as you say, like, yeah, Richie Dixon's probably a big part of that in a way has kind of been forgotten. And I think maybe because Milton Hague's been their coach for so long now, people forget it ever wasn't. I've had that thing of just like, wasn't Milton Hague the coach? Like when Georgia declared independence in the 90s? He's just always been there. Speaking of like always been there, David Kasirava at 13, who has like 130 caps now. Again, I love him. He does nothing. He is just a purely defensive 13, and he doesn't like, he is pretty much scared of getting the ball on like Dan Park's levels. And when he does, he just walks into the closest forward. And I love him inexplicably because he's just like, this is what I do. I can't really do anything else. If I do, I get confused. So I will stick with that. I will have a beard and make tackles.
And my favourite memory of David Kasirava was the 2015 World Cup when he played against Marnano and Conrad Smith with, I think it must have been Sharakadze playing inside him maybe. By this point. Yeah. And Marnano and Smith are probably going to the game expecting to go pretty well. Smith being the guy who usually pisses off a lot of other outside centres. And this time he was getting well and truly Conrad Smith'd and Kasirava was just not giving him an ounce of space. He's like, why is Skyo's tackling me? It's not that good. Like, I can't get an inch of space here. Yeah, he was great, Kasirava.
There's a great moment in that game where Conrad Smith looks like he's gone for a cap and Kasirava actually picks him up, like Gavin Henson on Tate style, and kind of wraps him under his arms and carries him backwards and drops him. And it is this... It's one of those great moments that happens in World Cups where kind of like 6 out of 10 players show up world-class players. Yeah. And I love that. You know, like the Gareth Moore skinning O'Driscoll and those kind of moments of a player who's decent really making their statement, the thing they'll remember forever. We mentioned as well a Georgian kick that didn't go very well with the Mariko Kashvili one. There's another moment, I think you've picked up on where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Where it's a really nice counter-attack by Georgia. And I get to Tondua, who again has been around absolutely forever.
Yeah, he's been forever. Yeah,
I barely remember a time, you know, other than Georgie Skinnan, of any Georgian winger wearing that 11 shirt otherwise. And he passes to one Dimitri Basilai, who somehow, off the back of this World Cup, signs for Edinburgh, which generally I thought actually had a very good game.
Yeah, but he did. He had a great game.
He has a moment in which, if you're a coach, you're going, do we really want this guy on our team? Because the number 8 breaks down the wing and tries a chip over the top instead of charging over the top of Max Evans, who's having this kind of game in which he isn't particularly fond of tackling. And he's the only man between him and the try line. He tries a chip and it goes beyond the advertising hoardings. It's nowhere close.
It is one of those moments of the cameras are on me, I'm going to try this, even though I'm forward, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm gonna have a go. Just gonna see if anything can possibly happen.
That's the relief on Max Evans and Rory Lamont's faces when that ball goes into the stands.
Yeah. Do we want the final part of my trilogy of bad Georgian kick bits?
Sure.
Go on then.
So there are two moments which has happened, but there's one in particular, I think, towards the end of the first half, in which Scotland are in the Georgian 22, and it's happened a lot in that first half. Like Scotland sort of got into the 22, then just got turned over. And it wasn't even an impressive bit of work from a Georgian player. They just weren't protecting the ball and they just let someone sneak in and nick it. That happens and Georgia somehow come up with the ball. And it's one of those you look at and go, well, that's surely illegal. But seeing as it's George Clancy, you're like, oh, it's a rare ruck where he hasn't given a penalty, so we'll let it go. And Georgia then pass back to the pocket and I think it's the fullback who tries to clear it. And he doesn't even send it as far as the ruck.
Yeah.
Which means that Scotland have made 5 metres off being turned over. And I think Andy Robinson looked at that and went, I want to base my entire World Cup game plan around that moment.
And the worst thing is, Gigari, the Georgian fullback, did the exact same thing a minute later. He thought, yeah, well, my last kick went well, I'm going to try it again. And again, he slices another kick, which does make the touchline. And it probably does make about 20 metres this time.
But he stood directly between the posts and tries to clear it into touch. Barely makes the 22.
Yeah. His kicking was to be desired, safe to say.
That is one way of putting it.
There was one point, it was Machika Shaleni, the 14, smacks Graham Morrison in the face.
I missed that.
Right in front of the touch judge. Right in front of the touch judge, and the touch judge just has this look of boys will be boys. And Kelly Brown is like, they're going, he's just punched him in the face. Graham Morrison is not a small man.
No. No, I love that it's the Georgian winger that does that as well.
Yeah, I had to go back and watch that again because I was like, not a really small man just punched Graham Morrison. And I was like, oh yeah, he did.
It's just small man syndrome. He's spending all his time around these massive stone Buddhas and just thinking, well, I've got to make my statement somehow. Can I make a stone bleed? No, but maybe I can make an accountant bleed. I
guess he must want to look hard in front of all his friends because it's not like he's winning any fights in training, is it?
Yeah. Well, I'll pick on the Pardis looking back in the Scotland. Like,
he begins eyeing up the pack, going, Hamilton, Strock, no, let's move on. Yeah. Let's go to the backs.
He wanted to hit Dan Parks, but he was on the other side of the pitch. Can you know what was coming?
Yeah.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
One note as well, just on mentioning Strokosh and Kelly Brown. Kelly Brown, I thought as well, had a good game.
Yeah,
I
yeah. Kind of. Talking about solid decision makers, yeah.
Yeah, this is the interesting thing. Now, there are two squibs on this team. Do you know what a squib is?
I know the Harry Potter sense.
Yes, a squib is a non-magical...
I know where you're going.
A non-magical wizard. So they're born into a wizarding family, but they have no magical powers. So according to, and this is official because this is on the Pottermore website written by J.K. Rowling, Jim Hamilton and Kelly Brown are squibs. And so is Stuart Hogg, but those three specifically she has mentioned as squibs. So there's this whole thing where she's written, because she's a big fan of Scottish rugby. You see, occasionally they'll pan to her at Murrayfield. So there's this whole thing that Scottish rugby is a meme in the wizarding world. It's a massive in joke. So they don't support any, they don't follow any other human sports other than Scottish rugby because it's a massive in joke.
I've got to say, in terms of the squib she selected, Chunk was robbed.
Yes, exactly.
So it's Jim Hamilton as a distant relative of Hagrid, isn't he? That's
that's it, yeah. That's how it goes, yeah. That's the joke there, yep.
Isn't Greg Tonks mentioned as well?
Because no, it's great. Stuart Hogg is the third
Stuart Hogg, yeah. Okay, I was sure she mentioned Greg Tonks because of the Tonks in Harry Potter. Or was that just on Twitter?
Oh, she may well have done, yeah. I'd be very surprised. I mean, I would think that Greg Tonks would be very, very surprised if he'd got anywhere near a magical family.
Yes. That is not unfair. I do love the thought of this kind of forgotten 10 fullback from Scottish rugby being a part of Harry Potter canon. And when people read through Pottermore in detail in years to come, no one will know who Greg Tonks was.
I don't think he's even got a Wikipedia page.
Bless him.
Do you think when it comes to people like Luke Hamilton, Nick Haining and so on deciding they'll play for Scotland, do you think it crosses their mind like, oh, you know what? I could one day get written into Harry Potter like canon here.
Who knows? We did. Do you, you know the story about what we did with Nick Haining, don't you? You heard this? Well, when on Twitter there was this big, everyone saying, well, who's Nick Haining when he got announced? I went onto Wikipedia and wrote that Nick Haining was a trained ballet dancer and trained as a ballet dancer in his youth.
Yes.
And also that his sister was someone called Tegan Haining, who was just someone, an Australian person that I found that was had a website who trained David Beckham in the past. So we put this on Wikipedia I just linked to her website.
Mm.
It got in the, I think it got, it did, got, definitely got in the Telegraph. Somebody just like repeated it, that he was a ballet prodigy in his youth. And then Edinburgh Rugby had to do a video where they had to get him to publicly refute that was a thing.
That was where I saw it. That was where I was kind of incredible. Like, why is he bringing up the fact he wasn't a ballet prodigy?
Yeah.
Surely we just assume he wasn't a ballet prodigy.
And then he said it was his mate back home. He said it was his mate back home that put on there, which enraged me. So I had to contact Edinburgh Rugby directly and said, hang on a minute.
Fact check.
Yeah.
Does he know? Does he know you did that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think he knows now, yeah.
Right, okay.
That's incredible.
That's funny. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's always a good tip. So if anybody that gets in that call, a surprise call-up rugby's a good one to do because these players' Wikipedia pages are like, there's nothing on them.
Yeah.
So anybody gets called up, surprisingly, just get on Wikipedia. You've got at least 24 hours grace to do it and stick something on there. You need some sort of citation to make it feel real.
Yeah. Okay.
This is where I reckon within 24 hours of this podcast going out, I'll be able to go on Wikipedia and see somebody start a rumor that Kyle Stain was in Teletubbies or something like that.
It wasn't Teletubbies.
It was.
I suppose you pull that as an example.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was genuinely in Teletubbies.
He's right.
He was a green Teletubby for 18 years.
He's a Nunu.
He was Nunu. It's funny and convenient you bring up CBeebies on. When we've got Cammy on.
Yeah, that's my other podcast.
Yeah.
We look at CBeebies, which requires me to look, well, it doesn't require me because I choose to do it, which requires me to look up CBeebies fan fiction and fan art, which
is
incredibly disturbing.
Yeah. As someone that spent more time than he should reading Sonic the Hedgehog fan fiction, yes.
Yeah. I mean, Macapaca, what he did to the Thumblyboos, it doesn't bear repeating.
Racist.
What we also found when we did the Teletubbies episode is we discovered that there is, inexplicably, there is Harry Potter and Teletubbies fan fiction in which Snape somehow takes the Teletubbies under his arms and then has sex with them all except for Poe, because Poe's a child and Poe watches.
Okay, is Jim Hamilton there? Does he intervene? No? Is this canon?
I don't know if it's canon on the... certainly, I would very much doubt it's canon on Harry Potter, but whether it's canon on Teletubbies, who knows?
I hope there's a registered canon of Teletubbies' work in the way people go so religiously on Star Wars. I hope there's people really keeping track.
They have Tiddlytubbies now, which are like baby Teletubbies, which just... The problem with that is it opens up this whole question of, will they reproduce?
That's it. Okay, so you might know better than me. Are they the children of the Teletubbies, or is it like a Muppet Baby situation?
I don't know. Well, they go to... Because I've got kids now, so they're in like a nursery wing of the Teletubbies dome.
Okay.
So I don't know how they got there. I mean, the best theory we could come up with is this is like... what's that film with... Jim Carrey, where he doesn't know where it's not Ed TV, it's the other one that came out at the same time.
Oh,
where
Truman
they're in
Show.
Truman Show, that's what I mean. Yeah, well, it's like a Truman Show situation, I think.
I can't believe
they're somehow bred
Ed TV,
in from eggs.
Not Truman Show.
I think it's because I preferred Ed TV at the time.
Wow, okay. Okay, this is a whole other tangent.
Yeah.
I won't even begin. Sorry, Tiddlytubbies.
Yeah, so the Tiddlytubbies. The best explanation we could come up with is they're grown, they're incubated somewhere,
right?
And then they're dumped into the zone,
Did you do a PhD on this?
No, just a podcast, which I think legally I should be given a PhD. We've done 20 so. Episodes of podcasts looking at CBeebies programs.
Do you think that's maybe what they use the aerials on their head for? Are they their reproductive organs?
That was certainly one of... There are lots of pictures of that on the internet.
Oh, no, I'm sure there are.
Always have your safe search on that. Having looked for colouring in pictures for the kids, always put your safe search on.
I've got to say, I mean, the recording of this podcast has not really ceased to amaze me so far. But when talking about Scotland versus Georgia, sure, I was bored when I watched the game, but I did not expect we'd be talking about Teletubbies porn within an hour.
You'd be surprised how many conversations lead there. You'd be surprised how often this happens.
Maybe
welcome
for you.
To the internet.
Oh, I think it's on the same section as Lego porn on Pornhub.
Now that I'm more familiar with.
I've never heard of it.
That we've established.
How to follow that up?
So, rugby. Does anyone like rugby?
Well, I mean, the Scotland scrum half thing's interesting. You could go to Scotland scrum half. Greg Laidlaw nearly made this World Cup.
Mm.
Of course.
Because he makes his debut against the All Blacks previous year, doesn't he?
He does, and he's in the wider training squad for this. And Chris Cusseter reckons he was lucky to make it ahead of him.
Wow, okay.
Which is a real shame, because then we have the match. Because post this, when you get to the first Six Nations game, Dan Parks wanted to retire after the World Cup.
Yeah.
Andy Robertson forced him to play. I don't know what he had on him, other than his terrible kicking record, to then persuade him to go and play against England, where he got... Who did he get charged down by?
Charlie Hodgson.
Charlie Hodgson charged him down.
Charged down tries, that's Six Nations.
Yeah. After then Dan Parks retires immediately. Greg Laidlaw then is Scotland's number 10.
Yeah. That was... I sometimes think on that there was a year in which Greg Laidlaw was an attacking-minded 10 instead of Greg Laidlaw.
Weirdly, nearly scored the winning try against England when he came to the bench.
Yes.
Yeah, like inches away. That was a proper, like, this is the headline for days now. Almost try. Yeah, I had a note as well with Rory Lawson starting this game. I did think, like, he's aged really well.
Yeah, doesn't he?
Like, he's become, you know, he's a handsome man now in a way, like, he's so much less Aardman than he was, in 2011. And I'm sure there's porn of that out there as well. I'm sure there's Aardman of, like, Rory Lawson ex Murph. Morph, rather. Either way.
It's his hair, isn't it? Because his hairstyle never changed. And even now, he has exactly the same hairstyle.
Mm.
I don't think it ever changed, other than at one point he had a little bit of a rat's tail at the back. But I don't think that on top it's never changed at all. I think he just wills it into that shape.
Even in lockdown, he's the one hair that hasn't grown wildly out of shape / had his head shaved.
And this is the weird thing as well, because the start of this game, when they showed the coin toss, Rory Lawson isn't tall, right? But he is towering above both the referee and the Georgian captain. Yeah. So I couldn't work if he was standing on a box or whether or not they were just exceptionally small. Because I had to go away and check, and I think he's 5'10". So that's not like, you know, I'm 6'1".
Because it was the Georgian scrum half was the captain.
Yeah. Abu Sarice. Yeah, no, I was going to say, did either of you watch his post-match interview after the game?
Yes, I did. Yeah,
where he basically just tears into his
team. We all wanted more, didn't we? This game we hated, and we all wanted more.
And he just seems like so mildly pissed off at his team, even though, you know, they've pushed like a tier one side pretty close. And, you know, I get that regularly teams will say, like, you know, we're disappointed not to get the win and stuff. But instead he just goes, yeah, I'm disappointed. We didn't play very well. They were fine. They were okay. But we weren't very good.
To the point he was. I mean, like, I wrote down the first thing he said, which was just, we play no good. They play well.
Hulk sad.
Yeah. As well, his accent sounds a bit like, you know, the Muppets movie where Tina Fey's doing the comedy Russian accent?
Yeah.
That's pretty much exactly his accent. And I know confusing the Russians and Georgians is problematic, and I probably just started the war. But he also, the other thing I wrote down that he said was, we got a lot of penalty, no?
Yes.
Which, again, sounds like he so fits into that Bond villain stereotype.
Yeah. And so he's not wrong, though. I mean, both teams' discipline was dreadful in this game. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that might be the fact that George Clancy was in the middle. I can remember just how much I was dreading this game. I summed it up in my notes at the start of the game. I just put, Jesus Christ, why did I agree to this? I've just heard the Black Eyed Peas while looking at George Clancy's face, knowing it's all going to go downhill from here somehow.
Okay, so the Black Eyed Peas thing. This is interesting. So I think, did we watch the version on YouTube with the Georgian commentary?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes. So when that Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night, because it was 2011, it had to be that or Moves Like Jagger. Playing. No, it actually is Moves Like Jagger.
Moves Like Jagger does come on at one point, I think.
Yeah. They play it right at the beginning. And at first I thought it was, you know, it was diegetic. It was the music in the stadium. And it isn't. The Georgian coverage is just playing that in the background as they're talking. And it isn't even like the radio or a version like ITV would do where they play an edit without lyrics.
No, it's got the Christina Aguilera bit. Yeah.
Yeah, you can hear the whole thing and all the lyrics in a different language in the background. And then when they get into the teams coming out and, yeah, everyone running onto the pitch, they're playing this really ominous music, like something that plays in like a dungeon scene in a film. it sounds like they're being tortured as they come out of the changing rooms. It's really weird.
I think that's just Ali Strokosh leaving the Chamber of Secrets, to be honest.
They've got Basilia Basilisk.
Nice.
There's a.
How did it take us that long to make that link when talking about Harry Potter earlier on?
I know. I can't let him jump on it right away.
Yeah. Nobody has Teletubby sounding names though. Looking at the team sheet now, so give up on that one.
Todua could be a Teletubby.
I think Alan Jacobson probably could be a secondary Teletubby character. He could certainly inhabit the Teletubbies universe somehow.
I reckon he's a fan of Tubby Toast.
The face in the sun.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know what? I have an anecdote about the face in the sun. From the Teletubbies.
Go on, sure.
So there's...
I'll allow it.
This is a rugby podcast. So I had a friend at uni, and once... believe it, I had a friend. But I asked her randomly this thought came to my head when chatting shit at some point at about 3 a.m, probably.
Mm.
Probably whilst at a house party drunk or something like that. Look at me, I got invited to a party once.
Oh, I'll get you.
But, yeah, I know. And I randomly, just to break a silence, asked the question, what do you think the baby from the Teletubbies is doing now? The son. And then she was just there like, she is about to start her third year at uni and works in a shop somewhere. And I was like, wait, what? And like, yeah, I went to school with her.
Wow.
So wow, that was just a weird coincidence, yeah.
I can throw up a similar former child star story.
Mm-hmm.
And involving Have Party if we want it.
Sure. What's the point?
So it's Scotland George 2011, go for it.
I once got a call from my friend James, who I kind of used to do like comedy writing stuff with prior to... He doesn't care about rugby, he won't listen to this unless I mention it explicitly, I mention it at the end. But basically, he once rang me and told me this story, because he'd just been at a house party in Manchester, where he lives. And he'd walked into the kitchen of this person, you know, this friend's house party... And he knew everyone there except for one person who was sat at the dinner table. And there are a series of lines of Coke on the table.
I was just thinking to tell
you. And he kind of looked over and he saw this one kid, just this one, you know, man, like 25, like massively overweight ginger guy, snort this one line, then get up, clap his hands and walk out the room. And because he knew everyone but that guy, James said to the friend whose party it was, who was that? Who's that guy that's just done 4 lines of coke and walked out of the room? And his friend said,
"It's like
you know the kid." Yeah. He walked out of the room to go and find some Romanian hookers. Marius Tinker.
Carry on.
He said, yeah, so who is that kid? Who is that guy that just walked out of there? And his friend said, do you know the ginger kid from the first Nanny McPhee? It's him. That's I don't know if I'm legally allowed to tell that story, but it's secondhand, so I think it's fine.
That's amazing.
I think technically you're saying the ginger kid from Nanny McPhee, you haven't named him, you're fine.
Exactly, yeah. Could be any ginger kid. There must be extras in that film.
The other thing just about how bad this game was is the fact it's in Invercargill, and Nix Johnson, who follows us on Twitter and has been on the podcast a couple of times, said she was at the match. She says, you drive into Invercargill. It actually has a sign that says, Invercargill, the arsehole of the world, Sir Mick Jagger. Right? And she said they're so proud of that that they actually changed it from Mick Jagger to Sir Mick Jagger when he got knighted.
I saw that. I absolutely love it. That is pure gold. Or pure arsehole, which might be a higher currency in him.
And I can't think. I mean, Robbie, you were in Japan, so you might correct me on this. But this is probably going to be one of the last times that you had people literally standing around a pitch at a World Cup rugby match. It's like proper provincial rugby. And you probably had that back in the... I mean, I remember, you know, it must have been the late 90s World Cup where they were playing matches in Gala Shields with temporary stands. Do you know what I mean? But this is like 2011, but there's still... It's because New Zealand and everyone knows everybody. It's just there's some people stood around the pitch. It's like, wow.
The same thing in like the... it's the Fiji-Namibia game where like Tynes Kotsur knocks a drop goal over and... Someone's just there behind the post to catch it, just like walking around because they didn't have a stand on that end. And it's that kind of weird thing. And I said the same thing on another episode of like, this is the last World Cup game I remember where there's just blocks of empty seats in the crowd.
Mm.
And it's funny how much it's blown up so quickly because this one still felt like an event in a way. I think kind of 2003 is the first World Cup that felt like a big deal. And it's grown and grown so much each time.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's just that it's probably the nature. I know kind of Alan were kind of talking about this when they went for the bid that it's the last time to get a small union hosting it because of the costs. But it really probably was the last time you would get these really little, like shitty provincial grounds hosting World Cup games. I mean, this must be the second, first one was in New Zealand, wasn't the second World Cup one that was in England. Yes. And they had games in Otley. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You say that something like in 1991. There was a Rugby World Cup game held in Otley. I mean, it's inconceivable now that you would have that happen. It doesn't feel that long ago.
Well, because the smallest stadium in 2019 was still like 28,000 people.
Yeah.
Or 20-odd thousand people, something like that. And that was given games, you know, on like a... Kind of actually on the... Because it had the earthquake and it had this kind of natural disaster and it was like a goodwill thing. And it is now. Every World Cup stadium will 90% sell out and is... needs to be, you know, a 30,000 seater. And so it is amazing, as you say, like they came from Otley and they had games in like the Knoll and, you know, like small grounds in Wales. It's bizarre the way it's grown so quickly.
I did this point... another one in the 90s, which one must have been the one Scotland must have co-hosted it. There was definitely around in the borders somewhere because my brother was at school at the time and they bussed in school kids to support Uruguay and gave them all Uruguay scarves.
That's terrific. Yes, absolutely. I'm 100% behind that.
Yeah. At this point, I think it's my obligation to say, again, if anyone's listening from World Rugby that wants to host an international match at Long Eaton Rugby Club where I play, then hit me up.
what's the facilities like, Will?
It's pretty good. I mean, Wikipedia claims there's like 1,000 capacity. I'm not really sure about that. But I mean, we've got a gym and we've got a good bar that serves like 3 beers.
It's 1,000 capacity if you can stand on the pitch.
Yeah. Which, funny enough, even if you're playing the second team, you can't.
Yeah.
All right. I would go for it. My bid would be Skremiston because that's where Berwick Rugby Club play, which is my club. And that's literally you get every single season. It's right on the North Sea. You get every single season and a day there and whips around something rotten. And it's
a proper rugby ground, isn't
it? It's proper could you do it at Skremiston on a wet Wednesday night? Territory.
Yeah, Dan Carter.
There's a video because it's Scotland and it's small and provincial. There's most players will have played there at some point. You know, there's a video of Stuart Hogg at 16 making his sevens debut. He made his sevens debut at Skremiston. Sevens debut at Skremiston.
There was a pitch I played on a couple of times when I was in under 16s that was on a hill, and it was like one half. You had a huge advantage.
You say that like it's not normal. Like most grounds play it like that.
It was a proper steep incline.
Yeah.
Like you tripled in speed. And I remember having been in a literal uphill battle. I was playing fullback and it was not going well. We were like 50 points down and the opposition fullback was really good. And I remember him kind of looking like he was making a break down the other side and me thinking, well, at least I'm not going to tackle him. There's no way I'm getting across there in time.
Hello, Dan Box.
And then he does this massive arcing run, right round, beats everyone, comes straight at me. And I just had this moment of thinking, I've got to literally run uphill to tackle him. And I just let him score. And it was a proper low point. But yeah, as I say, it was my Dan Parks defence moment.
When playing in fullback in that sort of a game, when you were in the half where you're at the top of the hill, did you ever catch the ball when it was in flight as it was coming up to you?
They genuinely didn't kick it uphill, which is really annoying. Like, yeah. I didn't take a single high ball in that half. It was a bit rubbish. In fact, I remember having a really bad game and being really miserable that whole day.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, yeah.
We're talking about that game instead of Scotland-Georgia 2011 now.
Yeah.
We've done everything we can do to avoid talking about Scotland-Georgia. Yeah.
Has anyone got anything else at all to say about Scotland against Georgia from 2011?
Just the only thing I would say is Dan Parks and Ewan, Ewan Murray's celebration at the end, which is now, it's one of the top GIFs when you type in Scotland rugby on Twitter, the three chest bump. Did you see this?
Yeah, no, I missed it. Yeah, I saw this.
So they grab each other's fist, they grab themselves by the fist and they do like a triple chest bump.
Right.
And it's obviously like, it's obviously choreographed.
Yeah.
That's something nobody else on the team does it. It's not like something the team is doing. It's weird to see a prop and a fly half doing it. So I don't know if they were rooming together or what, or whether they just bond over Bible passages because this is the kind of, you know, our best prop using for a Sunday.
When you say that that's the third highest gift, is the second by any chance Ali Strakosh and Joe Ansbrough butting heads after that Australia win?
No, that's surprisingly hard to find. I think one of the other ones is there's a lot of drunk fans. A lot of it's Finn Russell doing dancing on the sidelines.
The dance, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's Greg Laidlaw ripping his shirt off as well.
Yes.
All right. On that, I will move on swiftly, finally, to our designated Dick of the Day and Man of the Match. So, does anyone want to start on Man of the Match for us?
Sure. Okay. I think Zibzibadze for Georgia and Basilei both played well. I've also written, for Scotland, I've just written down Chunk. I don't care about what he did during the game, but just, I love him. However, I'm going to give it to actually Rory Lamont, because I think he actually took a lot of big hits during that game, but still kept hold of the ball. It was not an easy game to be playing fullback, and he actually did pretty well, made a couple of good breaks out of it, so...
The fact he was able to do that despite being manipulated by the 5G signals coming out of the ground nearby.
Yeah, I think that's a fair call. I mean, I think Sean Lamont had a good game as well. Rory Lamont's a really sad one because he's one of the great lost fullbacks of Scottish rugby. Because he retired at 30, so he probably had a good couple of, were it not for injuries. You know, Scotland lost their fullbacks overnight because Chris Patterson retires shortly after this. Rory Lamont gets injured. So then you just have Stuart Hogg, because he makes his debut in the Six Nations after this.
Of course, yeah.
So it's a real kind of like sudden changing of the guard. And you kind of like, well, what would have happened if you could have had kind of like Rory Lamont guiding him through? But I think he had a really good game. I think in the forwards, I think they gave it to Kelly Brown. I couldn't tell because they were speaking Georgian. They just lingered on him for a while and said something. I think they've given the man a match to Kelly Brown. He had a really good game. Ross Rennie had a really good game. So I think equally either of those would have been up for it. Again, Chuck, I would give any game of rugby, I would always give Chunk Man of the Match. When the blog turned 10, we did a kind of, we did an awards, a fake awards ceremony. It wasn't fake. We didn't actually have real awards, but we decided on some awards and Chunk was our cult hero of the decade. And we reached out to him and the only response we got back to him was, "What do you mean, cult hero? I'm not player of the decade, ? For fuck's sake."
Just cements his cult hero status as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He's doubled down there. That's terrific.
Legend.
Yep.
So, Chunk is your man of the match, Cammy.
Chunk's my man of the match. Call. I think just being able to kind of recover the ball whilst a Georgian literally had him by the shirt. An indestructible shirt as well.
Yeah. And I also think they scrummaged really well. Scotland probably got on top against a really good Georgian pack.
Yeah.
And you look at that team, David Zerikashvili goes on from here to be one, you know, be just completely dominant for Claremont for years. And all of that team are playing in the top 14. Terrific pack. And yeah, I think genuinely he had a terrific game.
Yeah.
I think Basilei, as you mentioned. Sorry, come on.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you think, it's a bit like WP now. Like, guys of that stature, you don't see many of them coming through, but with modern scrum rules, they cause all sorts of problems because it's so low. So it's really hard for the opposition prop to kind of deal with.
Yeah, yeah.
The scrumming's so low, and it's almost like a wrestle now rather than a push and a shove. So kind of, Chunk was before his time. Imagine, so, like, Chunk now. Oh, God. There's a thought.
I know. Oh, I'm always thinking of Chunk now. I think Basilei had a very good game. And as you mentioned, Zibzibadze, and I love Merab Kokashvili, and also just being able to kick a penalty from your own half, wins you points for me. But I think the one player that I looked at, and every time he touched the ball he seemed to do something, was Sean Lamont. I thought actually he made, and you know, giving a winger man of the match in a game in which there are no tries feels a bit generous, but he was the only player who looked like creating anything. You know, he made a few breaks and half breaks. And
he's the only one that understood the concept of 3D chess.
Yes.
And yeah. I think therein lies the problem, because there was loads of times where he would get the ball and he'd break the gain line, but rather than the player falling up, being on his shoulder in a position to have the ball pop to them or pass to them, they were anticipating him getting tackled and going into a ruck. So there were loads of times where he was ready to give the pass, but the players, like, was these, you know, his man was literally on top of him, so they just all collapsed in a heap and then it would get recycled. But if they'd just been a couple of inches back, he could have popped the ball and they would have been through. So, yeah, you know, I think, and again, that just shows his longevity, because he was right through till, I mean, he actually refused to retire from international rugby.
Yeah.
He said, I don't, you know, I'm not going to retire. I'm never going to rule myself out. They'll leave me. I'm not leaving them, kind of thing.
And good on him. Good on him. Like, if you get the chance to play for your country, and as he did for a long time, he won 100-plus caps.
Yeah.
More power to him.
He played sevens for Scotland in the Commonwealth Games, didn't he, when he was aged about 50?
Yes, he did.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He was one of those players you could actually, by the time he retired, see grey hairs coming through. And big fan of that. And you move on to Dick of the Day.
Sure. Dan Parks.
I don't think
there's much argument about that.
No. So, no, I haven't nominated Dan Parks, but Dan Parks is the reason why. So, Basileia, who, yes, he does that chip that goes out 5 metres past the advertising hoardings, basically lands, like, way beyond the people just having a picnic on the side and in the Cargill. However, I started, in order to entertain myself a few minutes in, started keeping track of which Georgian players were putting cheap shots on Dan Parks. Of the starting team, I mentioned as well the replacement lock, Shivakadze, puts in free after coming off the bench. So 9, Abzantadze, the scrum half, puts in one quite early on. You've then got number 7, number 2, number 3, number 1, number 12, and number 6. But other than the 2 second rows who were busy and jumping lineouts and stuff, the only Georgian forward not to put a cheap shot on Dan Parks is Dmitry Basileia. And worse yet, he had 2 chances to do it, and both times he pulled out.
Coward.
Once he goes for a charge down, and he kind of then just doesn't shoulder him or anything. And the other time he's headed in with a shoulder after Parks has touched, passed the ball, and he pulls out.
Coward.
So, when the rest of his pack are all... What is the first maxim of forward play, right? You always target the opposition fly half and try to hurt him needlessly. Basileia had 2 chances to do that, and it's damn bloody Parks. He could have come off and we could have seen Mossy at 10, which would have been fun if nothing else. And then, instead, no, he did not take his chance. And for that, he is my dick of the day.
I think that's a good call.
That is a good call. That's a good call. Rude of you to assume Mossy would have played tennis there, Jeff Cross, though, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's the weird thing about this game. They don't empty the bench.
No.
Yeah.
And I know as well, like, Richie Vernon, really mobile forward. They don't, like, he didn't come on. They keep the entire front row on, and they've got an 11-day break after this.
Wow, yeah. And because it wasn't that long a break since the Romania game.
No, and I looked at, then, there was an interview with Al Strokosh on, again, the Scottish Rugby YouTube channel that I managed to dig out, where he says they literally got 1 day of training in really bad weather between the games.
Okay.
Because it's quite a short time. I don't know, it must be like 5 days or something. Because this is the World Cup where there's the big complaint about the treatment of Tier 2 nations. Yeah. I think it's where it kind of kicks off, isn't it? But they, I mean, that behind the Thistle book, they're all talking about how angry the team were about how the benefit England got to playing it under a closed roof.
Yeah.
On the basis Scotland were kicked off down to England for Carvergill for their first 2 games. I mean, in terms of fixtures, you want to get your games against the Romanians and Georgia out of the way first.
Yeah.
They're almost like warm-ups. But by the same token, England are getting to play in big stadiums under a closed roof in dry conditions.
Yeah. And they also get that kind of bonus of that Argentina game first up being a big game to get yourselves up for.
Mm.
In a way, I think Scotland were caught a bit cold by Romania and starting really well against Romania, and then they came back into it. But yeah.
Mm.
I think we've probably waffled for long enough.
I was going to say, we spent 20 minutes talking about Teletubbies and now we're managing to talk about the game. We're an hour in.
Yeah, that's it. My man of the match is Tinky Winky. Done. Okay, Cammy, thank you very much for joining us. Have you got anything you want to plug, anything you want to mention? Where can people find you?
No, we are on Twitter. It's at Scott Rugby Blog, and you can go to our blog, scottishrugbyblog.co.uk, and you can find all the old podcasts there and all the links to how to listen to it. We try and do, because it's lockdown, we're trying our best to try and do different things. So we've got one coming up on the 97 Lions, Living with the Lions, which is just looking at Ian McGeachan and Jim Telfer and their coaching. So we're keeping it as we've been accused of being parochial, and we're very proud of that. So we're trying to keep things as parochial as we possibly can. It's in the title. With the Scottish Rugby Podcast, that's what we talk about.
Nice.
Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to checking not only that out, but also the CBBS podcast. So yeah, I'm very excited for that. And thank you again for coming on. It's been very good having you on. It's been enlightening.
Good. I've enjoyed it. It's been nice. It's been nice to kind of, I feel like I've exercised some ghosts tonight.
Yeah. Finally got them out of you. Those terrifying Georgian ghosts. Well, thank you very much, Cammy, for joining us. Thank you, Will, for joining us as always. Thank you very much for listening. And good. I'm glad. I'm glad Nottingham Rugby Player of the Year, Will Owen. Thank you for joining us as ever and for listening through the CBeebies chat, and we'll see you next time when we should have a actual, not quite current, but a player who played in last year's World Cup on. And I don't want to say in case it doesn't happen and there's a chance it might not, but that's exciting. A player who played in the game we're talking about. So we'll see you then for that. Thank you very much. Good night.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.